listening to a program produced in 2010 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. We learned some startling, even counterintuitive things about war from Sebastian Younger in his new book. The prize-winning author of The Perfect Storm and a contributing editor to Vanity Fair, Younger was embedded for many months with a single U.S. Army platoon at a remote outpost in eastern Afghanistan. Only 6 miles long, the Korangal Valley is a tiny place, yet 42 American soldiers have died in it. The men of 2nd Platoon are young, heavily armed, and crammed together in a tiny mountain outpost, supplied by helicopter and surrounded by enemies determined to get inside. They're there for a year, together, and the adrenal rush of combat can be, as Younger writes, insanely exciting. It's a world where everything is important and nothing is taken for granted. And after combat, ordinary life can look pretty boring. War is a big and sprawling word, Younger writes, but combat is a different matter. Combat is the smaller game that young men fall in love with, and any solution to the problem of war will have to take into account the psyches of those young men. And that is something that we all have to grapple with as communities across this country as our veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan come home. Sebastian Younger has been awarded a National Magazine Award and a Novartis Prize for Journalism. With Tim Hetherington, he directed the documentary Restrepo, which won the Grand Jury Prize at Sundance, and I'm sure you'll hear some more about that tonight. And we're very fortunate, indeed, to have in conversation with Sebastian Younger tonight, John Sackrett Young, an author, producer, director, and screenwriter who has written often about men and women at war, as well as the way that war colors their lives ever after. John won his first Writers Guild of America Award for his adaptation of Philip Caputo's book, A Rumor of War, the only American miniseries about Vietnam. And many of you probably know him as the co-creator with William Broyles Jr. He also wrote and executive produced the groundbreaking series China Beach. For his work on that show, he received numerous awards, including a Golden Globe, Peabody, and People's Choice Award. He was also honored by the WGA with his second Writers Guild Award for an episode he directed. He's written a miniseries about the Gulf War, Thanks of a Grateful Nation, and his book Remains Nonviewable, which he spoke about here at Aloud, about his family and his cousin's death in Vietnam, was a Los Angeles Times bestseller. And he's writing a script now about Iraq and Afghanistan. I think he's the right person for this conversation. Please welcome Sebastian Younger and John Sackrett Young. Thank you.
Sebastian, I want to start even before your time in the Korangal Valley and talk about Afghanistan, because you were there, in a sense, not the other side, but not embedded, if you will, with Americans. Talk a little bit about your time, if it will, the first time.
I first went to Afghanistan in 1996. I had a magazine assignment in Kashmir to write about some Western trekkers, hikers, who were kidnapped by guys who had come out of Afghanistan, who had fought the Soviets and Mujahideen, basically, who were working out of training camps in Afghanistan. They captured these people and killed them. And so I decided that the root of the story really was Afghanistan, the chaos that followed the Soviet withdrawal. So I went there in 1996, right before the Taliban took over. In fact, I got shot at by a Taliban position on the outskirts of Kabul. And I left, and like 2 weeks later, they took over everything.
And so what were your feelings about the country at that time?
You know, it was a country in an incredible amount of pain. It was quite a, not quite unified, but quite a stable place in the 70s. You know, one of the best medical university in Asia was in Kabul. It was a very cosmopolitan city. The hippie trail ran through Afghanistan in the 70s. Europeans and Americans enjoying the local botany, basically. And and then the Soviets came crashing in and tore the country to pieces. And then they pulled out. They were defeated because the U.S. had armed the Mujahideen, and they were called the freedom fighters then. They were fighting for their country, and the independence of their country. But when the Soviets pulled out, the U.S. pulled out. And they pulled out all support. And so the country, filled with, full of weapons, its infrastructure smashed, really fell into chaos in the terrible civil war. So, you know, what I saw in that country then was were people who were tired of fighting and hoping that someone would, that the West would come back and intervene in some way, bring some stability. It did not happen until 2001.
So when you went back, let's talk about first maybe what was the impetus or the germ idea of the book? Was it to do with Vanity Fair, or what started you going back in terms of being with the 2nd Platoon?
Well, I kept going to Afghanistan. I was there in 2000. I was with Ahmad Shah Massoud, who was fighting the Taliban very heroically in the north, very completely outgunned, outnumbered, but holding on. He was killed right before 9/11, 2 days before 9/11, and so I rushed back there after 9/11. I was with his fighters when they took Kabul. I remember walking around Kabul being hugged by Afghans, complete strangers, because I was American. I mean, there I am in a Muslim country being hugged because of something the U.S. military had done. It was pretty interesting experience. We were really seen as liberators. They hated the Taliban. They saw it as a foreign occupation by Pakistan. And then after that, the war was so easy then. The Taliban crumbled immediately. The Afghan population was so grateful. It looked like it was the end of the story. And then, the U.S. left something like 15,000 troops there. To give you an idea, there's 40,000 cops in New York City. It was not going to work. The Afghans knew it wasn't going to work. They couldn't understand that, 3,000 American civilians were killed on 9/11, and that produced 15,000 soldiers in a country that desperately needed help.
Just pull your mic in.
Yeah. All right. As the war went on and got worse and worse, I thought, okay, this wasn't a quick story. My country and Afghanistan are going to be intertwined for quite a while, and I need to understand the other side of the story. I'd always been with the Afghans, Africa. I'd been with the local population in those civil wars. That's, for me, what reporting was, is you're with the people. And I thought, okay, now I want to know what the other side is like. What's it like being with the U.S. military? They're a very important player now in Afghanistan, and I wanted to understand what it was like to be a soldier. I went there. I was with Battle Company of the 173rd Airborne. I was sent there on assignment for Vanity Fair magazine. I'd worked for them for a long time. I had a kind of side gig with ABC News. So I was shooting, my partner and I were shooting a lot of video that was used by ABC Nightline. But the real goal of that, far beyond the Nightline reports that we did, was to make a documentary about life as a combat soldier at a remote outpost.
So we'll get to the documentary, but was the idea... So the idea for the documentary pre-existed, in a sense, the idea for the book. Would that be...
No, to break down a little bit further, I'd been with Battle Company in Zabul province in 2005. I didn't know anything about the U.S. military. I grew up during Vietnam, in Cambridge, Massachusetts, essentially. A very liberal place. I didn't know anyone in the U.S. military. And when I was with those guys in Zabul, I was just so impressed by how professional they were, how good they were, how dedicated they were, the officers and the enlisted men both. And I thought, if these guys go back to Afghanistan, I had great, great problems with the idea of Iraq. I thought it was a huge strategic error on our part. The Afghans thought it was a huge strategic error because they essentially watched us walk away and off to Iraq. And I didn't want to cover that, but I thought, if Battle Company goes back to Afghanistan, this country I really care about, I want to follow one platoon for a whole deployment. And so that's where the genesis of the idea came from. And it was the concept was to pay for it by doing these articles. And in the end, I would write a book and I would make a documentary film. So I got a video camera and learned how to shoot.
So this book has a rather prepossessing title, this thing called War. And I guess to paraphrase Tolstoy, which, all wars are alike and each war is unique in its own way. Talk a little about, from your sense, and certainly from the book, you did a lot of reading and you've obviously talked to people, some sense of how this war was unique as well as, and we'll get to other things like war versus combat, something you talk about quite a lot about, but just in a larger sense, what is your perspective or feelings about the particularity and the uniqueness of this war?
This war is probably the most low-intensity war that this country's ever fought, and in some ways, fortunately. The casualties in Vietnam, forget about World War II, in Vietnam were, 100, 200 men a week. That's what the U.S. is losing every year in Afghanistan. So they're really on a different scale. It's not a mechanized war. It really is a war fought by men on foot in very rugged terrain, and particularly where I was in the East. So on a kind of tactical level, we've never had drones before and things like that. I mean, on a tactical level, it's different. But for the foot soldiers, for the guys on the ground, I don't think it's changed much since Vietnam, World War II. I think, and one of the reasons I named the book War, I didn't want people to think the book was about the war in Afghanistan. It's certainly not a political book. What I was trying to do was discover the universal experience of combat, something I think hasn't changed much war to war, century to century. What is it like emotionally for young men in combat? And so I chose that title because I wanted to project the most universal possible truth.
But in a sense, it is different. I mean, I think about at least World War II. The company of men may be similar. You refer to sort of the American experiment in the makeup of the platoon, et cetera. But it's in World War II, theoretically, at some point, you may be shooting at someone at a distance, but the distances have changed. I mean, right, our ability to kill at long distance puts you further and further away, in a sense, from the enemy. Though there are times when they're right there, but it's sort of this odd, almost to me, surreal sense that you can be shooting at someone who is how far away? I mean, it can be not just 1,000 yards; it could be a mile or 2 miles. You mentioned with a 50 caliber.
Yeah, I mean the 50 cal goes back to World War I. So I mean that basically line of sight warfare. I don't think it's changed much. There's a lot of fancy weapons that the guys I was with were not using. I mean, drones and that kind of thing, that's a different aspect of the war that I really didn't cover. This was a platoon of infantry in a very, very rugged place. They carried everything they needed on their backs, and when they dug into positions, they used shovels and pickaxes. I mean, it was pretty old-fashioned looking.
Talk about the topography, the country, too, because it's... looking at Restrepo, the documentary, it is at times, I would say, gritty and in certain ways ugly, but other times it looks beautiful. And war has that sort of strange ability of being, in one way, horror right next to beauty.
Well, Afghanistan is just a gorgeous country. It's just, it's gorgeous the way the United States is. There's parts of it that look like Nevada, parts of it that look like Colorado. It's just a stunning place. The people are very, very handsome. Everything about it is just huge and grand, much like the American West. I think it's one of the reasons that people, reporters, keep falling in love with it. Where I was in the Korangal Valley, it was in the east. It was by the Pakistan border, east of Jalalabad. There's a six-mile-long valley in the Hindu Kush Mountains. The valley floor is around 4,000, 5,000 feet. It looked like Colorado, very steep hillsides with holly oaks going down into the lowest parts of the valley where there was a river, it's sort of filled with boulders, a very powerful river. It was kind of dry down there. As you went up the slopes, it got more and more moist. And so then you had holly forests, and then finally you had these huge cedar forests. I mean, cedars that look like sequoias, enormous, enormous trees, 4 or 5 feet thick. They were so big that you would look at a neighboring hillside that might be a mile away and you would think it was just a few hundred yards because the trees were so huge.
Now, the flip side is there were certain elements that, let's start with everything from heat and humidity to flies and tarantulas, right? I mean, there's sort of the the other side of beauty, if you will.
Yeah, there were certain elements up there. I mean, as I say in the book, it was this sort of anti-paradise. Everything that young men enjoy was not up there. I think you can probably guess what those are. And everything that people don't like, most of those things were up there. I mean, tarantulas and snakes and scorpions. It was incredibly hot in the summer. It was incredibly cold in the winter. There was no, at Restrepo, there was no running water. The guys were out there for a month at a time, so they lived in their clothes for a month at a time. There was no internet. There was no phone. There was no cooked food. There was no way for them to communicate with the outside world except for the main base. And there was an enormous amount of combat. A fifth of all the combat in all of Afghanistan was happening inside those 6 miles. 70,000 NATO troops in that country, and the 150 men of battle company were absorbing a fifth of the combat.
I'm going to read. This is, I think, pretty strong writing. It's a miraculous kind of anti-paradise up here. Heat and dust and tarantulas and flies and no women and no running water and no cooked food and nothing to do but kill and wait. And when you see the documentary, Restrepo, it's like one moment in the film, you feel like you're going to die of heat prostration, and then suddenly there's a section where snow is everywhere. So it's a startling environment that's obviously very powerful. And in some ways, maybe there's a kinship to the West, but also in looking at the documentary and knowing a little about it, it's very alien, too. You really feel like you are, at times, on another planet.
Yeah, and the people were very intense looking. The old men dyed their beards red and sometimes shaved their heads, and you know, some of them were really crazy looking people. Some of the really old guys in that valley, because of the red beards and stuff, and they really looked like they're out of Tolkien or something. It was an interesting population. They had been expelled from Nuristan about 150 years earlier. Some tribal clan conflict, and they sort of emigrated, 20, 30 miles from Nuristan into the Korangal Valley, which apparently no one wanted. And it was, very, very steep-sided. They had to terrace their fields, incredible workmanship, building their houses out of stone. I mean, really tough people living in a very, very tough world.
Let's talk a little about the men that you were there with. In the book, you sort of... The documentary is built around Restrepo. You want to talk a little about him? And then the book is sort of built around O'Byrne. But let's talk about some of the men, because they are fascinating.
There were people from every race, every place that the American experiment has touched the world, Guam, the Philippines. There were Latinos there. There was one black guy in the platoon. It was an incredible sort of
spectrum.
I was
a little surprised, knowing a lot about Vietnam, that there was not, at least that I could gather, that many African-Americans in terms of percentages. In Vietnam, it was a pretty significant percentage.
I asked, his name was Jones. He was an incredible soldier, and I asked him about it. I think there is a sort of socioeconomic reality to the military. It's a job. It's a guaranteed job. If you're from a part of American society where you need to find a job and it's hard, the Army's there waiting for you. And I'm sure there are a lot of people like that in the Army. But it's very easy to join the Army and work on a rear base changing the oil in Humvees. Very easy to do. What's not easy to do is to get into an outfit like the 173rd Airborne. The guys who were in battle company... It's one of the best brigades in the military. Battle Company was probably the best company in the 173rd. You really have to want it. You have to pass through all kinds of schools and tests, jump school. It's brutal. And so the guys that were in that unit in Battle Company really wanted to be there. They wanted to experience combat. When they went over there, they said that their main worry was that there wasn't going to be any combat and they were going to be sitting around all year.
Talk about a little bit of Brendan O'Byrne. I mean, he starts your book, and at some point you describe him as maybe being made of scrap metal, as I recall.
Yeah. Brendan, he's the main character of my book. The guys the guys, I think, at different times were quite thoughtful about what they were doing. What are we doing here? What's it mean to almost lose your life over and over? What's it mean to be killing other people? I think they had those thoughts, but not everyone voiced them. Not everyone had them out loud, and Brendan did. O'Byrne did. He and I became very good friends. He's the only guy that got out of the Army. Everyone else is still in the military. About a third of the platoon, the original platoon that I was with, are back in Kunar province. They finished their deployment in August 08, December 09. They shipped back out again. Right now they're back in Kunar province fighting. Guys in my book are back there already. Brendan got out. He was from a very tough background. His family had a lot of problems. There's a lot of alcohol abuse in his family, in his childhood. And that situation erupted one night into a pretty good fist fight between him and his dad shot him. So, just a quick story. I mean, I found that out because, and I was up there, I did 5 1-month trips out there. So on my third trip, I was at OP Restrepo, which I'll describe in a minute, but very, very remote position. We were in, they built these plywood hooches to protect them from the cold. And it was, we'd come back from patrol and O'Byrne kind of wandered in and started talking. And he was like, oh, I think I'm going to write a book someday. And someone said, why are you going to do that? He said, well, it's just all because of all the interesting stuff that's happened in my life. And like what? And Brendan said, well, you know, for example, my dad shot me. And then everyone kind of, an uncomfortable silence.
Shot him twice, actually.
Although, to be fair, it was through a closed door, so he didn't, you know. Brendan actually took the fall for it. He said that his father had shot him in self-defense. And so Brendan went to reform school for assault with two bullets in him. And in reform school, he formulated the idea of joining the U.S. Army. And so now here he is at the most combat-intensive outpost in the entire U.S. military on a five-degree night on a hilltop. Kind of hell on earth. Without any irony at all, he goes, but, you know, it's all for the best because if my dad hadn't shot me, I wouldn't be right. I wouldn't be where I am right now. And so this other guy, a guy in his team, goes, well, he's like, I'm not buying your damn book. but what he meant, I mean, just to sort of like continue on that a little bit, what he meant, I think, was that, I mean, he was a kid who was self-destructing. I don't think he would have survived his 20s on the path that he was on at 17. And the Army, I mean, in his mind, in Brendan's mind, it kind of saved his life. Like, it straightened him out. It made a man out of him. It made him accountable and responsible. There was a downside to it that, you know, I can talk about. But for that 18-year-old at that point, getting out of civilian life and straightened out by the military was probably a very good thing. And I think that's what he meant when he said that.
Kearney. Captain Kearney. Is it pronounced Kearney or Carney?
Kearney, yep. Yeah. Captain Kearney.
6'4" or something? Tall guy, big guy? It's tough to tell in the documentary.
Yeah, he's Kearney. He was the company commander. It was a company-level operation in the Korangal, so he had responsibility for the whole valley. All of 26 years old. When I was 26, I was waiting tables very badly in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Because of his level, you know, I was 46, you know, I was 20 years older than him, but his sense of authority and command of the situation was so tremendous that I felt like I was younger than him. I mean, it was really sort of bizarre. Big, tall, handsome, strong guy. I mean, he really looked like he'd been cast in a movie to play, you know, the captain of a company of infantry. Very articulate, very smart guy. All the officers were incredibly smart. I sort of later figured out, like, the Army doesn't put bad units, they don't put bad officers in bad places because they'll get chewed up. They put the best men in the worst places. And that's what my experience in Afghanistan, my experience with the U.S. Army was not representative. It was not sort of a cross-section, a fair sampling, because I really got the best of the best. Kearney was definitely one of those.
Talk about Restrepo for a...
Restrepo was the platoon medic. Every platoon has a medic. His job, obviously, when the guys get in contact, if someone's hit, his job is to save that man's life. Keep him alive until he can be put on a medevac and rushed to a real doctor. So medics are very, very brave guys. I mean, when someone's hit, they move through gunfire without regard to their own life. It's pretty extraordinary, and they're really admired for that. And Restrepo was not only very brave and a very good medic, he was just an incredibly nice guy. He was really sort of beloved in the platoon. And he was one of the guys that, in the isolation out there and in all the combat, he was one of the men who kept their spirits up. And he was shot in the throat in a small town called Ali Abad. I was in an ambush with those guys in June, my first trip in June. And, I didn't know it. He didn't know it. But, a few weeks later, almost at that exact same spot, he was shot in the throat. And he bled out. He was the medic, so there was no medic to treat him. He bled out trying to tell the guys, how to save his life, and they couldn't. And they were just devastated. The guys came off that deployment with a lot of psychological issues. But I think the most painful thing for them was not the times that they almost died, and everyone in that valley almost died, myself included. That was not as traumatic as the death of their friends. It triggered an incredible sense of responsibility and guilt and unfairness. Like, Restrepo was the best of us. Like, God had to have made a mistake. It should have been me. Why couldn't I have saved his life?
Rice is his name? Someone says, if the best of us...
Yeah.
What is the sense of it if the best of us, in fact, can get killed in such a strange, quixotic way?
Yeah, it's tough. It's very tough. War is pretty random. And so if the best guy out there gets killed, the best soldier out there gets killed, and you're half the man he is, what are your chances? I mean, that's how soldiers think about it. So when Restrepo was killed, it was incredibly traumatic to them. And there was a lot of guilt that they couldn't save his life out there. And so when they built Restrepo, the outpost, they named it after him. It was a small outpost on the high ground outside the main base, and the enemy were using that high ground to shoot into the base. Plunging fire was very effective, so the command decided to occupy that hill, put an outpost on it. And so 2nd Platoon, the guys I was with, walked up there with 3rd Platoon in the middle of the night with pickaxes and shovels and weapons, and they started digging. There was no sand up there to fill the sandbags, so they had to break up the shelf rock with their pickaxes and make rock, what they called rock bags, and they piled them up because they knew what was going to happen when dawn came. And dawn came, they got hit, and they worked and fought continually for 24 hours. They would chip away at the rock with their pickaxes, filling these bags until they got shot at. They'd get down, return fire. They were in 13 firefights that first day, and by the end of 24 hours, they had a tiny position to hide behind, and they started building it up. And that was the little spot that I spent much of 2007, 2008.
Talk a little about, because you talk about it, before we get to, let's say, grief, talk about courage. Because obviously you talk about it in, I think, a fairly significant way.
Courage, I became, when I was out there, as a reporter, you have to... Being a war reporter is frightening. Like, being a soldier is frightening. It's your own fear is something you have to deal with. It's not going to go away. It shouldn't go away. But you have to establish a relationship with it where you're in control of it, not the other way around. So I became interested in how fear works. I sort of studied it in myself. I observed it in the other men. I became very interested in how you deal with fear. And the sort of corollary of fear in combat is courage. I mean, if soldiers don't act courageously in combat, there is no combat. I mean, you have to willingly risk your life to function effectively in combat. So I became interested in how courage works, sort of neurologically, psychologically, sociologically. One of the problems with studying it, and the U.S. military, many militaries have tried to study courage. Like, how do you get men to risk their own lives for a greater endeavor for each other? Like, how do you get someone to do that? it's very hard to study with soldiers because they really sort of reject the idea that it even exists. And it's almost a kind of semantic question. I mean, I saw two soldiers, ER and Moreno, run through very, very heavy machine gun fire to drag an injured comrade to safety during one firefight. And I asked them about it later in ER. I was like, you know, I did that because I assume he would have done that for me. And it's the only thing that makes any of this psychologically possible, the comfort of that knowledge. You know, he said, I mean, if I hadn't done that, it wasn't that I was courageous. If I hadn't done that, I wouldn't be a soldier. It's the definition of being a soldier. So they sort of reject the idea that heroic acts in combat are heroic. They're like, no, that's the sort of minimum duty. And, you know, I sort of really thought about that. And I thought, you know, if a young woman's walking down the street and her kid darts into traffic, you know, she would dart after him to save him, not really thinking about whether she was going to get hit by a car. You know, and if she, you know, saved her kid and got back to the sidewalk and someone had tried to tell her that she'd been brave, she'd probably slap him. You know, it's like really not about bravery. And that's how soldiers see it. And so it makes it actually a kind of elusive topic.
Someone said, I don't know where I saw this, that it's like when you fall on a hand grenade, that's instinct the first time. But it was a story about a guy who did it a second time or something. First time it didn't go off and then he did it, it happened again and he did it again. And the second time was that the same instinct or was that something else? You know,
I think it's probably the same instinct. I mean, what I saw out there, the one of the main anxieties for the men was that they would have a sort of momentary lapse of courage, a lapse in their training, and they would do something or not do something that got someone killed. And in very, very literal sense, if one of their buddies was in trouble and they had a choice between staying behind cover and living or running through gunfire and risking dying to save their friend, they would do the latter. The idea of sort of going on throughout the rest of your life that you saved on that day by hiding behind the tree with the knowledge that you let a friend die. Not even friend isn't even the right word. A brother is really how they referred to each other. Brendan said to me, you know, there are guys in the platoon who absolutely hate each other, but we would all die for each other. And there really seemed to be an incredible comfort and reassurance for all of those men that that each man was necessary to the group and that everyone in the group would risk their lives for anyone else. And that was a very, very powerful agreement that they all had with each other. You know, I think it really, it's one of the reasons that when you hear soldiers say that they miss combat, it's very easily sort of written off, I think, as, oh, it's an adrenaline rush. You know, I think that's part of it. But I think the main thing they're missing is the kind of narcotic effect of being so closely bonded in a group like that. That is, I think, intoxicating in its own way. When they get back to the civilian world, all of a sudden that doesn't exist anymore and they really feel kind of at sea.
Yeah, there was a friend of mine wrote a book called Brothers in Arms, and I often think of the Company of Men. In terms of Vietnam veterans, not so long ago there was actually some Vietnam veterans from America went to Vietnam, and they had essentially was like a reunion with Vietnam soldiers who had been on the opposite side. But they shared this experience, and that experience was about some level was of war and fighting, but I also think it was about the company of men. Even if you're on the other side, you're in some experience which you alone have with these men or brothers who are with you.
Yeah, yeah.
Talk a little bit about and maybe it's in terms of Brendan O'Byrne or maybe, but it's coming home, which is to say, when it's over. Now, in the case, this is so soon afterwards, some of the men are obviously still there. But I think that's sometimes when it gets most difficult, is when you leave that company of men, when you leave your brothers, is what you're going to do in civilian life.
Yeah, I mean, none of them really return to civilian life. They're all still in the Army. 12 of them or so are back in Kunar province. The rest are in the military in different units, different bases. Brendan did return to civilian life, and it was very disorienting for him. He was a pretty troubled kid, and in the Army, he was a perfect soldier. He really was an incredible soldier, and it gave him a sense of purpose, an identity, a sense of himself, and a sense of his role in society. I mean, the society was only 30, you know, consisted of 35 men, but it was a society nevertheless. It gave him a sort of certainty of what his purpose was out there that he'd never had as a civilian and as a very troubled civilian. So when he got back to the world, all of a sudden, the things that were sure out in Restrepo were unsure here. You know, who was he? Can he trust other people? He said to a friend of mine, a woman, asked him. Brendan and I are really good friends. We talk to each other probably every day. And he met a friend of mine, a woman who asked him, "So is there anything you miss about it out there?" And she'd read the book. She read that paragraph about the tarantulas, you know, whatever. And he said, "Yeah, I miss almost all of it." What I wanted to do with my book is explain that answer. What is it? How can you take a young man and put him on a hilltop like that and almost kill him over and over again for a year, kill his best friends, bring him back, and he back to the pleasures of civilization, and he wants to return to combat. What is it that's happening out there that he feels is necessary to his sense of himself, that he's willing to risk losing his life to go back there to get it? What's not happening in society for a young man where he's willing to sort of make that trade and go back out? That was something that I feel it goes to the heart of combat. It goes to the heart of the psyches of young men. I think it's something that is not new and modern. I think it's something that's been going on for a long time.
It brings up two things to me. One is keep talking about men here. What about women? Obviously, essentially, there are no women up there where you were or where they were, and there's really no women in your book in that sense. So is what did that mean to these men, or is that, do you think there's any way that's going to change, or what's the role of women or no women?
Well, there were no women out there, no American women. It was an infantry unit, combat infantry. There are no women in those units. So, I mean, the boys would have loved to have had a couple, but you know, it wasn't going to happen. I mean, as far as women in combat, I mean, I don't know. It's a really complicated question, I think. I think women can probably fight just as well as men. A machine gun's not that hard to operate. I think maybe the biggest impediment out there at Restrepo, at larger bases, I think it's, my guess is it would work all right. Restrepo, there was just no privacy. I mean, Restrepo was the size of this room. The latrine was completely open. You slept in your bunk. I mean, you know, it's like the hooches were these plywood shanties that they knocked together, you know, sort of clinging to this hillside behind the sandbags. You're on your bunk and you can touch three other men by stretching out your arm. And I just think it would be, you know, you put one or two women in that situation, I think it would be extremely hard psychologically for them, but I don't know.
And talk a little about what sort of the men would wear by the end of their time there, or the, you know, how they peed or whatever. I mean, it has a certain lovely.
There's Lord of the Flies out there. I mean, seriously, that, because they were out there for a month at a time. They'd walk down to the main base to get a hot meal and call their girlfriends or whatever, and they'd burn their uniforms, which were all shredded, and get new uniforms and walk back up. And standards slipped. I'll just put it that way. I mean, it was the most exposed outpost in the U.S. military, and there really weren't any senior officers out there to reprimand them. And you know, it got very, very hot. So they figured out how to make flip flops out of the packing foam from these missile crates that they pack missiles in. And they'd sort of shuffle around, you know, when it was hot, you know, they'd shuffle around in those and sort of tattered gym shorts and, you know, bare-chested, smoking cigarettes. And so, you know, I have this pretty wild video, a lot of it, of, you know, the attacks would come very subtly. And if the men weren't on patrol, you know, if they're sort of lounging around the base in the heat and the boredom and the flies sort of spacing out, and then we got hit, and they'd all jump on the guns. And so we have video of these guys, you know, literally in like bathing trunks and flip-flops, you know, on the 50 cal. It was just extraordinary. You know, eventually, if the firefight went long enough, they'd put on their bulletproof vest or whatever, but a lot of them didn't even bother to do that. And it really was didn't quite look like the U.S. military out there.
If Brendan O'Byrne, who's back and is, let's say, at least probably struggling to find his place back in this world, and you talk about a little bit in the book about sort of the that in ordinary life, you know, your consequences aren't the same. The attention to detail that you need out there, and a little bit how they monitor each other, right? Because it can it can be danger or catastrophe if someone is sort of falling behind or isn't paying attention.
Yeah, I mean, very small things get people killed in combat. You don't clean your rifle, and it jams in a firefight, and you know your buddy gets killed because you can't shoot. So it made the men what I say in the book, what happens to you happens to everyone. If you dehydrate on a patrol, everyone has to stop because you're messed up and you have to be dealt with. So the discipline was lateral. It did not come from the top down. It was lateral. Men would remind each other, hey man, you got to keep drinking because I don't want to have to carry your ass back to the outpost. You know, tie your shoes. If we get hit and you're walking around with untied boots, it's going to get me killed. So, you know, tie your boots up. What would happen is that the men became extremely, I mean, almost kind of neurotically conscious of very, very small details in their lives. And it was interesting for me because I adopted that because I didn't want to cause a problem either. And it made you think about everything, absolutely everything that you owned, everything that you did. It gave you this almost kind of Zen awareness of you looked at everything you owned and everything you did for its potential to get you or someone else killed. And then you come back to society and things don't have real consequences. You know, if you don't drink enough one day, you just, you know, enough water, it doesn't matter. You know, if you don't tie your shoelaces, it's not going to get someone killed. You might trip and that's about it. And it sort of deprived the things of my life, the shoelaces and the, you know, the whatever, all the little artifacts of one's life, it sort of deprived them of this very intense meaning that the stuff had out there. It's kind of an intoxicating way to live out there. You're just insanely aware of everything. And coming back, it all looked a little inconsequential and pale. And I think that's also another thing that soldiers kind of miss is like, there's a kind of meaningless, there's a lack of consequence to civilian life that I think is in a weird way kind of troubling to them.
Yeah, I would actually argue that in a certain way, you use the word daze, that maybe we are in a daze here and there's a consequence to that, that, you know, when you're not aware of those things.
Yeah. There's definitely a heightened awareness out there and absolutely.
I spent in my small way some time in El Salvador while there was a revolution going on there 25 and 30 years ago. And Joan Didion, you know, obviously an extraordinary writer, wrote about being there. And when she left, she said how elated she was when she got on the airplane. I found that when I left, I was actually starting to get depressed, I think because upside downly, I felt so alive while I was there because there was so much danger. Even if I was in the middle of of all of it, I still felt close to it and people were dying that I happened to know. And I think that's some of what they have a really extraordinary sense of.
I understand exactly what you mean. I mean, a situation has to get extremely terrifying for me to be really psyched to get out of there. But it has happened. I was in Liberia in 2003 when the lured rebels attacked the city. And I'd been accused by the government, the Taylor government, of being an American spy. So I was in an African capital city being attacked by rebels and hiding from the militias that were defending the city. I mean, basically everyone was my enemy and it was extremely scary. And I kind of got smuggled out by the U.S. Embassy in this armed convoy to this airstrip. And I got out with a few other people. And I mean, right up until I got onto the plane, I thought I was, you know, someone was going to, I was going to get grabbed. And it was like, I couldn't wait to get the hell out of there. So a little confession.
Let me ask you, because in a sense, it's almost posed this way. Do you think we could come up with something culturally or behaviorally to combat, if you will? You talk about young men and almost like their testosterone and the not the need for war, but once you're into it, that it gives as well as takes away. I don't have any idea what that would be.
I'm going to say something really outrageous here. I think psychologically, for some young men, there almost is a need for war. And by that, I mean not war per se, but there's a need for some kind of rite of passage, some kind of tangible proof that at age 17 or 18, that you are good enough, that you're manly enough, that you're brave enough, that you're strong enough, whatever it is. I mean, societies for tens of thousands of years have had rites of passage for young men to demonstrate not only to society, but to the men themselves that they are now adults. And they can marry and they can shoulder the burdens of being an adult in that tribe, that society. It's a very important thing to prove to yourself. And I think a lot of young men in this society go into adulthood not quite convinced in their hearts that they've made that passage. And I think there are guys who joined the army and joined a combat unit, maybe not consciously thinking that, but on some level in their heart, it was something that they needed to demonstrate to themselves. And I think if there was a way for that to happen in our society, a legal way, there's lots of illegal ways, but if there was a legal sanctioned way for that to happen, I think young men would take advantage of it, but I think it's actually kind of hard to find.
Yeah, I think the thing that you can't measure yet, I suppose, is, to quote Tim O'Brien, is the way the things they carry, that long-term, the aftermath has a sort of double-edged, sharp edge of the sword to it. Yeah. Because you come back and you can't fit in, you come back and you still carry the memories, you still carry the losses as well. And that's a big deal, and it's something we're going to be with us for a long time, whether it's literal wounds or other kinds of wounds. But tell me, what did Sebastian bring back from this time there? What, you know, obviously you've written about it in a way, but there are probably some things you didn't write about or that are even in the underneath, perhaps.
I mean, if you're in a lot of combat, you come back with certain reactions, and you can have some pretty intense dreams. I was quite, I've never in my life really had much of a temper. I had like a temper, like I was sort of snapping at people. The usual jumping at certain noises. I mean, the gunfire out, the fighting out there was usually at 200-300 meters. I mean, sometimes it was closer. I mean, there were situations that were pretty up close, but usually, you know, the ambushes and stuff, you know, the fighting would be at several hundred meters. And so when someone shoots at you at that distance, it's not loud. I mean, it's almost, you can almost kind of not hear it. It's like this sort of distant tapping sound. So, you know, a distant tapping sound will like definitely get my attention here. But one people always assume that the sort of emotional reactions to combat are all negative. And one of the things that was surprising for me was to sort of see that that actually wasn't quite the case. The negative ones, I mean, I didn't experience, I experienced a fifth of what those guys did, but I was out there for 5 months. But so I can't even compare, you know, me and them really. But for my purposes, the negative experiences went away. And partly because I think I'm older, my identity is clear in my mind. I had an identity to return to in society. These guys are really young and they haven't quite finished that work yet on themselves. But the positive part, I really became quite emotional. I mean, I had access to my emotions and in a way that I really hadn't before. I would find myself, you know, after my time out there while writing my book, I would find myself being really very moved by things and not sad things necessarily, just things that were moving. And, you know, and as a young man, you know, I'd see, like, I go to weddings and see, you know, women crying at weddings, and I'd think, what are you crying? Like, I just didn't get it, you know?
And now he doesn't get it at all.
And now, I'm much more in that camp. And it was almost like that experience, it wasn't the combat, it was the closeness of being in that group. It took me, you know, many trips. By the fifth trip, I was really part of that platoon, and I, as a civilian, but I was part of it. And I really cared a lot about those guys, and I know any number of them cared quite a lot about me. And that really kind of opened me up in an emotional way. I'm 48 years old, you know, like better late than never. But that was a tremendously positive thing, I think.
Let me ask you, and I'm sure it's come up already, that, and I know from my own experience, I once there was a well-known writer who was served in Vietnam, or as a reporter for the New York Times, named Gloria Emerson, and she talked to me when I was doing the show China Beach, and she said, she listened to my voice, she said, well, you're not a veteran. You weren't there. You're obviously, it sounded like you're from an Ivy League school or something. And I said, you're right. And she said, essentially, then you don't know, you don't get it. Now, much later, she sort of turned around once she'd seen the show and the sense that the show wasn't only done by those who served, but it was only about those who did serve, and it was trying to tell their stories. But you, I know, are going to have, it's someone's going to come up to you and says, in fact, I've heard the phrase, and not only about you, war tourist, or, you know, hey, there's a difference between a reporter and someone who's actually serving. You know, you, there's all, sometimes a club about combat, which is you're in or you're out. And have you had anyone approach you in that sense? And which also extends to, do you have the right to write this book in the sense that, you, right. you know, as if it were your experience?
No, no one's approached me like that. I mean, God forbid, you know, that like only lawyers could, you know, write journalistic pieces about the law, you know, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, I could just list all the professions. You know, soldiers are no different. I mean, the power of the free press is that you have people who are not emotionally engaged in the topic, writing hopefully with objectivity about things that are very important to this nation. So I think it's amazing that there are soldiers coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan who are writing their own accounts as soldiers of their experience. Absolutely essential. In every war that's happened. But it's equally essential that people who have no personal connection with combat and with the U.S. military go to those situations, go to those places, and try to understand them for the other civilians. It's absolutely crucial. And so, I mean, the term tourist is very loaded, but and I don't think it's really accurate, but I mean, God forbid that the only journalism we get coming out of war zones is written by, you know, Army public affairs officers. It would be a disaster.
Well, it's also, I think, probably the most famous or most renowned book about war, though he took a couple more words than just war. It was called War and Peace by a guy named Tolstoy, who did not serve in the war he wrote about. So
yeah, the red badge of courage, you know. Crane didn't serve either. It's a tremendously powerful book. So
yeah, let's talk a little about writing and your process. Like, how long did it take you to write the book, and did you know the shape of it when you began, and how much history? Obviously, you have a bibliography at the end of this, though it isn't so much a literary one and more of a sort of psychological, sociological, and historical one. What books are you aware of that were important to you, and what is sort of your writing process?
I mean, you know, every war reporter has read Dispatches, and, you know, after you read Dispatches, your most important job is not to try to, like, write another Dispatches. It's its own thing. It's a brilliant book, and then you kind of have to move on from it. So, but it is a reference point for an awful lot of reporters, I think. I really didn't read anything about the current conflicts because I really wanted a kind of clear mind. I was not interested in writing about the politics of all this. Most of the other books are at least partially political or geostrategic in their focus. I really wanted to go into this situation with this platoon as a completely blank slate and try to experience it as a human being. And afterwards, I did a lot of research about how fear works and sort of by extension, how courage works. I resorted to, you know, military studies about those things, civilian studies. It was fascinating material, and there are sections in my book that use that material in trying to sort of explain neurologically, psychologically, sociologically how those things work in people, and that's what the bibliography is.
Correspondingly, in the documentary Restrepo, was there did you look at other documentaries, or again, was it like, in a sense, a blank slate? I don't mean so much about Afghanistan or Iraq, but I mean, when I was looking at it, I even thought of a documentary made during World War II called The Battle of San Pietro that John Huston made as almost a similar structure to it.
You know, no, I didn't watch anything when I made that movie. I really wanted to be a blank slate. I mean, I grew up watching Hollywood movies, but I definitely didn't want to do that, make that. At some point, I watched a movie, an extraordinary movie about Vietnam called The Anderson Platoon. A French filmmaker was with a Marine recon unit for 6 weeks in the jungle in Vietnam. Structurally, a very flawed movie, but cinematographically, just absolutely mind-blowing. And I don't know at what point I watched that, but I don't think it informed our effort very much. But I really tried to keep my references to the book and the movie to keep them within the experience that of Battle Company and the experience that I'd had with them. I really wanted to be completely self-referential.
Let's I want to say thank you to this man to my right for the book he's written and the articles he's written and the time he spent to really.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.
You know, there's a real sense in this country, I think, that people don't want to hear about or don't want to pay attention to what's going on. And I think that's one of the many reasons this book is so invaluable. Now, I'd like to see if anyone has any questions. And there's a couple of microphones around, I think, somewhere. I see one in the air. Sir, let's start over here.
Did your colleagues at Restrepo ever feel it appropriate to, in their downtime, not that I imagine there was much, discuss their own private politics, or was that just inappropriate for the context?
There was a lot of downtime, actually, and no, they really didn't. They're 19, they're 20. I mean, I didn't have politics at that age either, you know. They definitely discussed what they thought were tactical mistakes or strokes of genius, you know, within the Coringal Valley, because that stuff really affected them. But they really didn't talk about the big picture. And I think they were right not to. I mean, it's not that they're not intelligent young men. They're at a different stage in their life. They're very young, and they're doing this job, which is already incredibly hard. And I think complicating it with opinions about whether ultimately it's the right or wrong thing to do, what are we doing here, what are we... They wanted to get home alive. That's what they were doing there. And the idea that they were trying to get home alive in the middle of a national strategic error wouldn't have helped. And for that matter, conversely, if they had really believed in being there, and many of them did, obviously, it also wouldn't have helped them get home alive. They really were quite focused on that and on doing their job well as soldiers, not killing civilians, doing what they were told to do, trying to push Afghan government control into the valley. They were trying to build a road to bring road into the valley. They brought in a medical clinic to treat the children. I mean, their job was not to just fight, and they were very, very focused on their tasks.
Well, let me ask you, since you're not anymore in your 20s, and you were 46 and now 48, what is your sense of the politics of the place or of what we're up to?
Okay, my reference point is the 90s in Afghanistan when it was just a bloodbath. My next reference point was 01 when something like 90% of Afghans approved of the U.S. military action. We really were seen as liberators for a while, and we blew it. We left 15,000 men there. It didn't work. It fell apart. And now the Afghans are really conflicted. I mean, no one wants foreign troops in their country, but if NATO pulls out, it's going to go right back to the 90s. I mean, forget about the combat in the 90s. Just the chaos and poverty produced an infant mortality rate of 25%. One out of four children were dying. The Afghans remember that. They know that. And so it's a little like police in a high-crime neighborhood. I mean, they're not necessarily the favorite, you know, beloved by the locals, but God forbid they leave. And there's a lot of Afghans who, I think, feel sort of caught between those two realities. People ask me, you know, is it winnable? Can we, you know, I mean, the West figured out how to drive the German war machine out of Europe. You know, the West pulled off D-Day. There's 10, maybe 20,000 Taliban fighters, you know, barefoot or practically barefoot in the mountains of Afghanistan. You know, if the West wants to solve that problem, I think they can probably do it, but they have to really want to. They have to want to like they wanted to make D-Day work. And America, I don't think can do it on its own. Every Western country has been attacked by Al-Qaeda or narrowly missed being attacked by al-Qaeda. The, quote, apostate regimes of the Muslim world, Jordan, Saudi, Egypt, Morocco, Algeria, they have all been attacked by al-Qaeda. The reason al-Qaeda was in Afghanistan is because it was a rogue nation without extradition treaties, and the only way to go in and get people who were wanted by international law was to go in with armed force, with a military. It's a perfect place for an organization like that. And what I kind of wish our president would do, and this is just sort of privately between me and you guys, is we've been doing this for 9 years. It's not working. We have an enormous debt, and we're fighting a fight that potentially, if we pull out of there, every other country in the world is potentially will potentially suffer the repercussions. And I feel like he should really say, you know, we've done enough. Enough of our people have died. If we don't get more help, more money, more resources, more support, more men from other countries in the world to help us in this thing, we're out of here. And we'll all take our chances after bin Laden and his crew move back into Afghanistan and set up operations the way they had before. I think the Muslim world should be involved in it. I think Western Europe should be involved in it. I don't know if that's going to happen, but I think if it did happen, we would have a very, very good chance of making it work.
Ma'am, yes.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a question about Massoud and your time. In your first encounter, you're talking about 1996 when you met Massoud and spent time with Massoud. What was it like returning to Afghanistan when he had died? I know you became close to him, and what was that like for you? And how different was that experience of spending time with the Mujahideen and Massoud and soldiers within the Panjshir Valley, and then returning back to the same country later as an American within the context of American soldiers? I know, I mean, for me, I'm an Afghan American and I go there very often. So for me, to exist within the context of my own family and like friends as an Afghan, and then to spend time with expats or American soldiers as an American, it's so strange. Like it's, yeah. And it's not that I don't I do actually relate to the American side of me. It's nice to speak English, and but there's like a side of me protecting the Afghan, you know, my heritage, and then there's a side of me, also protecting my American side as well.
I can imagine how confusing that is. Massoud was the leader of the Northern Alliance. In my opinion, a very forward-thinking, honorable man, a brilliant guerrilla leader, played a large part in defeating the Soviet military in Afghanistan in the 80s. And he held out in the northeast corner of Afghanistan for years against very superior forces, fighting the Taliban for years. And I was with him then, very impressed by him. And in my opinion, tragically, he was killed right before 9/11. It was part of the 9/11 plot. They did not want him and his military brilliance leading the Northern Alliance against the Taliban and against al-Qaeda with the help of the U.S. Air Force. That was not something that the Taliban and al-Qaeda command wanted. So they took him out right beforehand. It didn't quite work. The Northern Alliance did not crumble immediately. The U.S. military came in and they took Kabul. All of my reporting has been in my life until now has been with the local population. That's what feels right. That's what feels, you know, the important part of the story ultimately is what's happening to innocent people. That is for a journalist, that is sort of the heart of the matter. So for me to suddenly be with the soldiers, it was really confusing because suddenly the Afghans became not necessarily, but they became potentially the enemy. Every time we saw an Afghan, he was potentially an enemy. That for me was really confusing because I you know, I'd spent a lot of time there. I was incredibly fond of the Afghan people, and I was amazed at how quickly your feelings can shift to accommodate a new situation. We were getting shot at. I was almost killed out there 2-3 times maybe. And all of a sudden, you know, this great fondness that I had took, it didn't disappear. It took second place to much more immediate concerns of my own safety and my kind of new allegiance to these guys that I was with, who I was so close to. And, you know, I think if I went back there and hung out with the Afghans again, which I certainly will do, I'm going back there in the fall, probably not with the U.S. military. I think I'll do a quote, embed with the Afghan society this time. I think it'll probably shift a little bit. And one of the tricky things about reporting is that objectivity is just completely impossible. I don't think that's a problem. I think you affiliate with the people you're with. It's human. There's no way to avoid it. It's only a problem if you pretend that you're not doing that. As long as you're aware that that is having an effect on how you see things, I think it's all right. As long as you're aware of it. But I don't know. It was quite complicated for me.
Over here, let's try one from this side. Just wait a second.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed this presentation.
Thank you.
You mentioned several times you've been in potentially awful situations where you were almost killed. How do the people that you're connected to here in the United States, your family, whatever, how do they... How does that get put into place? You know, you're going and you were in Liberia and you said you were almost shot. How does your identity as a reporter, a war reporter, vis-a-vis, you know, if you have someone and a family here, how does that work?
I don't have children, which I think helps a little bit. It's hard though. I mean, what you don't want is to have, as a reporter, you don't want to have your wife or your husband or your mom or whatever it may be say, look, it's me or your job, and you got to stop doing this. It's too scary for me. So what journalists do is they come home and they minimize the risks that they took. You know, I didn't come home telling, you know, like, dramatic stories about how I got blown up by an IED. I kept that quiet as long as I possibly could. You know, eventually the book came out and the movie came out, and you know, what I didn't want is for my friends and family to worry on my next trip. So until the project was over, I just like didn't talk about it. And I know that's not a long-term solution, but that was how I avoided getting sort of told, you know, to choose somehow. And I'm not going to do this again. I mean, I'm going to keep covering wars and stuff. I think it's important. It's a job that I find really intense and gratifying. It's an honor to be able to do it. I like to think that I do it well. But I'm not going to spend 5 months with a maneuver unit at a remote outpost getting hit every day by small arms fire. I mean, I just like, there are reasons to risk your life. I don't think there are reasons to risk your life indefinitely. And I think I'm done with this particular phase of my reporting. I'll do something else.
There's in the documentary Restrepo, is it Mother's Day or birthday? This guy talks about talking to his mother, as I recall. Yeah. And he says, well, of course, I didn't tell her. You know, I just wished her, and so everything was great. Everything was fine, which in fact it wasn't. But you don't talk about those things. In longer ways, sometimes men who come back or men and women who come back from war don't talk about what happened for years, decades. That's not something that either you want to share or sometimes can share, except often with those men and women that you did serve with.
Yeah, it's the soldiers themselves, they find it very hard. I mean, while they're out there, they were censoring their reports because for the same reason I was. They didn't want to upset people who worried about them. But then they came back and they didn't talk about it much either. And it's not that combat's not interesting. Soldiers talk about combat. I mean, it's about the most interesting thing that they know. And anything that's that complicated and that has consequences that are that huge is makes for a pretty intense conversation. So it's not that they don't like to talk about combat. They discussed it all the time while they were out there. What's hard for them is to try to communicate something to people who can never quite know what they're talking about because they're civilians, and it's frustrating to them. You're not among the initiate, you know. You are civilians, and you could never know. And then there's another issue, which is if you're in combat, you've lost brothers. You've lost men you're really close to. And so that brings on some very powerful emotions. And to generalize here for a bit, men really don't like to cry in front of other people. I mean, just to put it really simply, it's just awkward. You know, it's like you don't really want to be at the dinner party. How was your time in Afghanistan? And you're like, okay, I'll talk about that. And then suddenly one thought leads to another, and you're describing the death of Restrepo, and suddenly you're crying at a dinner party. It's like you just, like, they don't want to do that. And so when they avoid the topic, it's because they know in their mind where it's going to lead. And I think that's part of the reluctance to talk about it later.
There's a moment also in the documentary where, I've forgotten who was, is talking about Restrepo's death, and he just stops talking. And he actually says something like, well, time out, I just, you know.
Yeah.
But he, even in his denial, he's sort of avoiding the fact of what is really bothering him, which, of course, is the memory and the presence of this death. He is already, he's sort of sidestepping. It's just like, you know, it's like I got a cough or something. It's not, as a guy, it's just tough to hit it straight on.
Yeah, I mean, the guys did plenty of crying. They just didn't want to do it in front of a TV camera or at a dinner party, you know.
Let's go way over here.
Thanks again, fellas, for some neat information. I was wondering, I've heard that the American government is forbidding Afghans to have arms of their own. Anything above just a pistol. Is that true? And if so, why do you think that is?
There's an Afghan National Army and police force, and those people are obviously armed. The rules of engagement are that if you're, I mean, in a conventional war, the combatants wear uniforms, they have weapons, they fight it out in the fields of France or wherever it is. There isn't much ambiguity about who the enemy is. In an insurgency, there's enormous ambiguity. So you need some rules about who can you shoot at legally and morally, ethically. Who can you shoot at and who can't you shoot at? And the rule basically is if someone's carrying a weapon, they're potentially an enemy, they're assumed to be an enemy, and you kill them. And so the rule that's put out there, I mean, of course, a lot of innocent people will get killed if it's a country full of weapons if they don't know that rule. So they've gone to great efforts. It was very clear in the Korangal Valley, if you're carrying a weapon, you'll get shot at. You'll be assumed to be an enemy. So what you can't do is have the civilian say, oh, yeah, don't worry about it. You know, you can carry around your AK if you want, but we also have this rule that you might want to know about that you'll be killed because we won't know you're not an enemy combatant. There are special cases that they're trying in certain areas where civilians have formed a kind of civil defense force in these towns to fight against the Taliban. And they're registered with the military, although they're not Afghan National Army. And so they're trying this experiment of arming in a very limited way some specific places, the local populace, because the locals, you know, they're stuck. Like, the Americans will say, the American military will say, you know, we'll try to convince the locals not to cooperate with the Taliban, right? But then the Taliban come in, and they have guns, and they're like, if you don't cooperate with us, we're going to kill you. And so the locals, understandably, are like, look, if you want us to stand up to the Taliban, we're not going to do it with kitchen knives. Like, so, it, you know, it's like, it's very complicated. And I think they're trying to find a balance. But the short answer is the rules of engagement over there are if you're carrying an AK-47, you're an enemy and you'll be killed.
Don't we have maybe two more questions?
Okay. Right here.
Hello, I'm from Canada. My name is Tony Hall, and
Canadian armed forces have been in Afghanistan since under NATO's auspices,
yeah.
since shortly after 9/11. And I think it's incumbent upon us to talk about the people who are firing at these great men you describe. You say the word Taliban as if that is explaining something. But if you're born Pushtun, the kids who's the children of these people firing back, you're going to be called a Taliban. And who are Al-Qaeda and Taliban? I mean, we know there was a lot of training taking place not only in these camps in Afghanistan, but in Fort Bragg. And Al-Qaeda is certainly not an external enemy. It comes from within. And you know about how the Mujahideen was trained by the U.S. government. So I was pretty shocked at the beginning of your presentation, your very short introduction about who the enemy are, that they're somehow alien, that they somehow are from Pakistan. I mean, it's their country, and they're in a civil war situation, and I just find it really, really dehumanizing and undignified to talk about the indigenous Afghanis, some of whom are firing at Canadians and Americans in the way that you did. I'm really shocked by it.
No, I understand what you're saying. I mean, the truth is really complicated. There were a lot of foreign fighters. They were foreign. They came. They were trained in Pakistan. They would come over the mountains. The Pakistan was only 20 miles away. They might be our ally, but that doesn't change the fact that they were being trained in the tribal territories outside of the auspices of the Pakistani government. And there were Chechens, there were Saudis, there were Yemenis, there are a lot of Pakistanis. The Taliban were in the 90s, not in the 80s. The Taliban were created in the early 90s by Pakistan. They were taken from the religious schools, the madrasas along the border in the tribal territories. They were trained and they were sent into Afghanistan to take over Afghanistan. So when I was there in 2000, the Taliban were not seen as an indigenous political group. They were seen as a foreign occupation, a proxy occupation by the Pakistan government. They bought, they co-opted, they threatened, and they, you know, in some cases convinced locals to join them. But the bulk of the strategic and political initiative was coming from Pakistan. Al-Qaeda, bin Laden's Saudi, obviously he has managed to reach Americans. And, you know, I think that's quite a coup for him. But the vast majority of Al-Qaeda are Arab-born. They moved to Afghanistan from Sudan. Because it was a rogue country and there were no extradition treaties. They were in Sudan before that, and that caused problems for that country, and they left. So what that leaves, I mean, when you say Taliban, it is a catch-all phrase. There's a whole spectrum. At the bottom of the spectrum, the least ideological are the local guys who are paid. At least in the Korangal Valley, the price was $5 a day to fight. They're very poor people. And so some of them, I'm sure some of those kids had ideological issues about all this. Some of them were also literally just paid gunmen. $5 to empty a magazine of AK, it's about 30 rounds, at an American position and run away. And when, you know, the U.S. talks about negotiating with the Taliban, you're not really going to negotiate successfully with Gulbuddin Hekmatyar. You probably will make some progress with the really low-level Taliban fighters. They're teenagers who have been hired on to this or threatened to join, threatened with death to join. I mean, they will literally be threatened by the Taliban to join their forces. Those guys, I think you can probably peel off from the Taliban movement. But you're right. I mean, but you're absolutely right. I mean, the phrase Taliban is a terrible phrase. It's too broad. It's too vague. The people that are shooting at Canadian soldiers, American soldiers, NATO soldiers over there are, you know, they come from many different countries, many different political positions, or no political position at all, actually. So it's not a good term, but it's a kind of shorthand for the enemy in Afghanistan.
We're going to take two more questions. If that isn't enough, there's still more. You can ask Sebastian while he's signing books, and if it's a short question, you buy one book. If it's a long question, you buy two books.
Hey, make sure you get Joe over here, the vet. He's raising his hand. Joe, Yeah. Let me just say that Joe here served in the Korngal Valley. He was at OP Restrepo, not when I was there, but very recently. So I just want to thank him for coming.
Sir, I just wanted to check really quickly. In my understanding of the Korngal, my experience is much different than yours. A couple of years later, with your experience, did you get word of other operations that were being conducted by the battalion as a whole, which was along the Peshawar River Valley? Did you feel that the positions in the Korngal served a purpose while you all were there? And the only reason I'm asking is because I was surprised at the tone of how this was all a mistake. And
you mean in the sort of public conversation about
yes.
it? Yes. Yeah. I mean, the logic of the Korngal Valley that I understood when I was there, I mean, the Korngal was 6 miles long. There was a few thousand people in it. It was very hard to argue that valley per se was important. But what it was being used, partly because of the geography, partly because of the local population, who were quite receptive. There was a real timber mafia in the Korngal Valley. They cut these cedar trees. They smuggled them out to Pakistan. It generated a huge amount of money. There was a timber embargo, so the local timber mafia were against the government for completely financial reasons. So it was a very good place to base, to have for the insurgents to base themselves. So they would use the Korngal to attack the Pesh River Valley. The Pesh was important. It's a major mobility corridor. There was a lot of agriculture. There was a lot of there was a large population. The USAID had built a trade school to train young Afghans in various trades so they can make a living. It was a very undeveloped area, so they built a hardtop road through the Pesh River Valley so that to increase commerce and the reach of government and the rule of law. So the Pesh was very, very important, and the insurgents were using the Korngal to attack the Pesh. It was incredibly dangerous to drive down the Pesh River Road. And when they put the base in the Korngal, they basically took the fight out of the Pesh into a place that didn't matter, strategically did not matter for the Americans. But it took it out, took the heat off a place that really did matter. So recently they pulled out of the Korngal. I mean, that's what was explained to me. And certainly when I was driving around there on the Pesh, it was very, very safe. The attacks on the Pesh dropped off tremendously. They pulled out of the Korngal Valley. There's been a lot of very angry and confused and conflicted feelings among the soldiers themselves about why that happened. It's a hard thing to answer. I think at the end of the day, if in something that's undermanned and under-resourced, the commanders decided that the 150 men that they had in the Korngal were better used elsewhere. I mean, I think that's the short answer for the decision to pull out. The sort of slightly broader answer is that war is very complicated. The strategy of each side is changing continually in response to the changes in the strategy of the other side. Commanders do not guess well 100% of the time. They don't have perfect knowledge. They certainly don't have any kind of clairvoyance. And so every war has its Dunkirk. We lost 30,000. We had 30,000 casualties at Dunkirk. It's hard to even imagine that. Every war has its Hamburger Hill and its Korngal Valley. And I think that's just the reality of war. And it's I think for the soldiers and for civilians, it's a very, very hard thing to accept, but it's the truth.
Look, sometime go to one of the Civil War battlefields if you want to see casualty lists and decisions that must have been, right or wrong, just horrendous to make.
Yeah.
Way back there, somebody in the dark, and that's the last question, I think.
Was there a protocol for you to carry a firearm, and did you at some point make a decision whether you would or would not fire upon the enemy?
I'm a journalist, so that's a huge no-no. I mean, you really can't carry a weapon It makes you part of the story. It makes you, it really threatens your impartiality. I'm not a trained soldier. I would probably have been more likely to, you know, like hit someone near me than the enemy. And I didn't need to. I mean, I was with guys who were incredibly professional soldiers and were perfectly adequate in defending all of us. You know, there was an incident while I was there. Chosen Company was in a very, very bad fight. They sent out a 28-man patrol. They got ambushed, and in a few minutes, every guy was down. Every guy had a bullet in him. They fought, the wounded fought on for another 3 or 4 hours and held off the enemy. They survived. I, thank God, was not in that situation. I was with Battle Company, not Chosen Company. But had that happened, and believe me, it was on my mind and everyone else's mind, you know, at some point, journalistic ethics cease and survival kicks in. And, I certainly would have helped treat the wounded. I think if it came down, I probably would have picked up a weapon. It probably would have been the last thing I'd ever done. But it never came to that, thank God.
I don't work for his publishing company, but by the book, he talks about this very thing in the book.
Thank you very much.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, Deloitte, K&L Gates, KPMG, Wallace Foundation, the Bujakci Foundation, Dean Hansel, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.